Joseph Felser says the reason why we're so caught up in trying to second guess the end of days is because we're caught. We're psychologically scarred between our natural state of living in a circular time concept to this flattened understanding of time as just being like an arrow through history into the future that will suddenly hit a tree and everything will come to an abrupt end. And there's lots of reasons to think about this. What else is there? If the Earth doesn't end in May of this year or December of 2012, then there'll be another date, and then another date after that, another date after that, until we finally get rid of this concept and instead focus on the circle. Everything tries to be round. We'll talk about Black Elk and what he taught us that we can still learn from today. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. So the myth of the great ending, Dr. Joseph Felser, the author who has a cool website too, everythingtriestoberound.com. Go there. We can put that link up at coasttocoastam.com. So we've talked a lot about the famous mythologist, Joseph Campbell, but yeah. I love the subject of Black Elk, and he gets quoted liberally in your book. Talk about him.
Well, certainly a powerful figure for me, and he was an Oglala Sioux, and he was born in, I guess, 1863. And when he was a young boy already, now, you know, we had that treaty of 1868, so-called Fort Laramie Treaty, when we agreed that we would not, the soldiers would take the fort down, disassemble it, so forth. We had already made inroads out there. And then a couple of years later, gold was found in the Black Hills, which were the sacred lands for those people. And, of course, that treaty was abrogated. So Black Elk is born, you know, during the time of the great, you know, Plains Indian Wars. He's born in a turbulent time when, you know, this and the Sioux, of course, were one of the last tribes to be put on reservation, to be, you know, conquered, assimilated, whatever you want to call it. So he's born in 1863, and he's one of those people that when you read the literature of shamanism, you know, the what we would call medicine man or medicine woman, the person who is the spiritual advisor to these tribal units, and this is all over the world. When they're young, they have strange experiences, and he was already having experiences where he was seeing things that weren't physically there. He was having, talking to the elements and having visions and so forth, little experiences that were sort of nudging him in the direction of the other world, the spirit world, I guess you would call it. And then when he was 9 years old, he had this, what the anthropologist, I guess, would call the shaman crisis, where he basically went just totally inward. I mean, he was physically sick. He was, his body kind of blew up, and his parents thought he was dying, and he's in a coma for days. And basically when this happens, and this is the typical shaman story, he feels himself lifting out of his body. It's an experience of ecstasy, what the Greeks called ecstasy, because the word ekstasis means to be out of yourself or out of your body. And he sees himself going up into the heavens, and he's actually taken to the Rainbow Lodge, the Sky Lodge, where he has this interesting session with the six powers of the universe. You know, he sees them as old men. He sees them as grandfathers. And he has this great vision that's described in the book Black Elk Speaks, which was written by John Neihardt, the Nebraskan poet. And the vision is a great vision. You have to read it in the book to really get the flavor of it. But the central part of the vision, really, that Campbell always liked to come back to, is that point where in the vision he sees himself taken to the central mountain of the world, which to the Sioux Indians there was what we named Harney Peak after General Harney, a great Indian killer. I guess there's an irony there. But
yeah, really.
Harney Peak in South Dakota, and he said, I saw myself standing on the central mountain of the world, and round about beneath me was the whole hoop of the world, and he has this vision of harmony and unity of what he calls, they didn't call it the circle, he called it the hoop. And, you know, all the hoops together and living as one. And the interesting thing, and the Campbell love to come back to this, is the fact that at that point in the story, when he's telling Neihardt this, he takes, you know, he gives it like a sidebar, and he says to Neihardt, but anywhere is the center of the world. So, you know, this comes back to the whole question of how we interpret these things, because if anywhere is the center, then where you and I are is the center as well. So you don't have to go to the Central Mountain in South Dakota. You don't have to go to Jerusalem. You don't. In other words, the center is everywhere. It's always available. And that's the way these people understood it. You know, I mean, there's this this wise Pueblo Indian teacher down in New Mexico. I think his name is Larry Littlebird. And he talks about this too. This is just the way that they're taught. And, you know, he was taught by his elders that, you know, when the earth is sick and out of balance and people are ill, that's the time to start over. He says, you know, there was nothing like a doomsday. Life is endless, and the world is so vast, there are always many possibilities, and they're right in front of you. And he talks about when he was a kid, and he was being taught by his elders, that he would just sort of show up, and there was no set time, and there was no set program, and he would just have this experience of timelessness, of getting absorbed in something. And, you know, you were talking before about how this arrow, you know, points us in a certain direction and it sort of governs our life. And we don't have this experience anymore. It's very hard for us to get, to enjoy this experience of being in the center and of experiencing not this moment, not that moment, but no moments. And that's what being in the center is all about, is experiencing that which is eternal, which, as Campbell points out, is not a long time, but it's totally outside of time.
You know, I see this this westernization of that kind of momentless or timelessness, or even you can make the argument kind of thoughtlessness, in this in the way in which yoga has been appropriated.
Yes.
Right? Originally, yoga being this emptying out of one's self.
Yeah.
So that one could just do better and be, and to let the thoughts come to you that would otherwise might be prevented because of all the harried lives that we lead.
Yeah.
But now yoga has become so focused on having a bottom line result.
Yes.
And yoga has never been more popular. And never actually further from yoga. Yoga has more to do with yogurt than it has to do with the original yoga. I mean, it's sort of this, it's now just become another kind of, you know, Taibo exercise.
Yeah.
Of strenuous, you know, heat yoga and all this other stuff that's going on that's all results oriented, not the opposite of that.
Yeah, it just becomes another tool for control instead of, as you say, an opportunity to relinquish control. And you know, again, this goes back to our basic fundamental attitude to nature. Campbell says the fundamental point about Indian lore was getting in touch with the harmony of nature and coming to the center. And this was true either in the Plains tradition, they had this tradition of, you know, vision quest, that was the personal ritual. And then the sun dance was the tribal ritual for coming to the center and getting in touch with that timeless moment. And, you know, we just don't have that willingness to surrender to things. We don't have that Taoist go with the flow. You know, we want to manage where the flow goes. We want to tell the flow where to go.
Well, and I think that there's truth to the need for that. And I think that, you know, it's funny you should mention flow when right now here in the upper Midwest, we're all very focused on what the spring floods are going to be like.
Right, right.
And we are literally it's villages already trying to manage the flow of what this melting snowpack is going to be like in 6 weeks.
Yes.
And the absolute terror of the snow that's coming in the next, we're still going to get more snow before all the snow starts melting. And yet, you know, but part of that comes back to that's because we built right up to the river's edge. That's
exactly.
Because we built permanent structures where temporary ones would have made a lot more sense. And
exactly.
So we're forced to do that.
Yes.
But we shouldn't. But one can argue whether or not we should ever have been in that place in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's what you say. I mean, we don't pay attention to the natural contours of things, and we want to remake the contours. So now we have all this problem with sea level and land erosion by the coasts. And in California, of course, you have the mudslides. But look where these houses are built. I mean,
right.
Once again, instead of trying to, I'm not against technology. It's not a matter of being against technology because development.
No.
Because, the first time, as Campbell says, the first time that some primitive proto-human being took two rocks and smashed them together, that's the beginning of technology. You're changing what was there to what you want it to be.
Sure.
So you can't be human and be against technology. But the question, I think, is how do we use it and what's our attitude toward it?
And when do we become a slave to that? And that's where we get more to the myth of the great ending, why we've been longing for the end of days since the beginning of time, Dr. Joseph Felser. Onto that technology thing, in the last 3 or 4 months, I had to have my right ankle reconstructed, and I am completely dependent on a very ancient form of technology, a stick, a piece of wood, as a cane. And I'm reminded all the time of just how, I mean, that gets as basic as a rock as a weapon is a cane as a mobility device.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's just a piece of wood. And
yeah,
this is
yeah.
how many thousands of years have people been using canes, a tree branch to get by on? I love the primitiveness of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, you can't get away from it. I mean,
no.
But there again, the so-called primitive attitude towards a tool is different than ours. I mean, just look in terms of that. In some of these ancient burials that we find, for example, starting with Neanderthal, about maybe 50,000 years ago, people are buried with their tools. Why? Well, one reason certainly is because that tool was not just a thing to be thrown out, to be used, to be disposed of. But that stick that you talk about had the spirit of the wood, of the tree. And when they carved it, they put their own spirit in it. So it was a kind of, amalgam of spirit between the tree and them, just like when we eat an animal, the animal becomes us and we become the animal, you could say, so that we're joined in that act of eating. So eating becomes a sacrament to these ancient people. And so these things, I mean, I buy a new cell phone, and it's just a thing. And when I get a new one and it has better features, I throw the old one away or I put it in my basement where all those, old computers and everything are. And it's just junk, you see, right? So
right.
There's no feeling of the sacred toward that. It's just a useful thing. And that's the way we treat the whole planet. It's just a useful thing.
But, I've been having this little thought about my wooden cane as I walk around. There's so much ice up here that I have to be very careful where I walk because I can't let this ankle go backward. I've got to do all the therapy and everything to make sure that it keeps moving back to a day when I can move without a cane. But in a way, my cane is like a divining rod. I look at it as sort of not to get too mystical about it, but that piece of wood has got to find the perfect place for me to put it.
Yes.
So that I don't fall down.
Yes.
So it's like a little, every time I take a step, it's like a divining rod to find a piece of solid earth. I want to get to something, since we're talking about basic technology, I want to read something from the myth of the great ending. And that's about another type of sort of fundamental tool. And that's the bucket. And you write here, all our mainstream religions and philosophies are rusty, worn-out buckets. They are outdated containers of antiquated ideas about reality. Some, like Swiss cheese, sport huge, gaping, crater-sized holes. Others appear to be more solidly constructed, but are split along the seams of the structure. All cultural vessels that are sinking fast, old systems of thought or ways of consciousness breaking apart and becoming useless, if not positively dangerous, in this perilous time. So we're talking about having these new constructs that hold more water, if you will. And I think there's some very interesting arguments you make about how this is true regardless of whether it's, you know, liberal or conservative. It doesn't really matter. The longer we carry one of these old systems around like a bucket, the likely it is to get rusty and have holes in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, just look at what's going on. I mean, our politics is brain dead. I mean, I don't care which side of the argument you want to take, but we have no new ideas. We have all we have is theater right now, and yes, that's partly a function of what we were talking about before, the 24/7 news cycle and so forth. But I think it's also a function of the fact that it's exhausted itself, and you know, it's like they're fighting over someone's died and the kids fight over the will. And that's what it reminds me of.
Or like we spend a lot of time pointing out how rusty and holy the other person's bucket is so that we don't see how much of it's landing on our own shoes.
Yeah, well,
out of our own bucket.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus said, don't, you know, worry about the beam in your own eye, not the mote in the other person's, you know.
Right.
And that's exactly what it is. It's a kind of theater designed to distract us from the underlying reality. And that underlying reality is that, you know, we're bankrupt as far as our ideas and politics go, and you know, we just don't know how to move forward, and so we're just going to sit back and scream at each other.
I wonder how many psychologists have worked with successfully getting people who are anxious, people who are depressed, off of a linear concept of time and into a more ancient cyclical one. Is anybody doing work like that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not in the field of psychology. I would imagine that there are. This person that I was talking about, I don't know about psychologists, but this person, Larry Littlebird, that I was talking about, I just came across him, and he has some kind of center down in New Mexico, I think it is, where people come and they relearn sort of how to get moments of bliss, if you will, about being, you know, it's out in the wilderness and
the whole sweat lodge thing.
I think it's a sweat lodge thing.
Well, no, I just mean, but I think there's a lot of people do that for that reason. They're trying to get off of a linear concept of time into something more transcendent.
Well, if you want to do that, go down to the Monroe Institute in Virginia. That's where I went. They took my watch away for a week, and you listen to some sounds that come out of a set of headphones, and it puts you in some timeless moments, and it's a heck of an experience. So I think there are ways of getting in touch with that, and you don't have to go anywhere. I think, like Black Elk said, I mean, I think we all have experiences of this when we were kids. I know I did. When you become so absorbed in something that you forget the passage of time. I mean, have you ever been so interested in what you're doing that
right.
you don't realize that an hour's passed, or that, you know, I'm late for an appointment or whatever it
right.
is. That
literally happens to me all the time on Coast to Coast.
Well,
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, well, that is. I mean, you know, that is a moment of eternity, because eternity means that time is exploded. So it's a kind of, you could think of it like an hors d'oeuvre of eternity. Now, maybe it's not a big mystical experience, but it's what the psychologist Maslow would call a peak experience. And that peak experience is a kind of like mini mystical experience.
And
that it is something where you experience the harmony of being in the moment. And I don't think that these experiences, I think sometimes, you know, when we talk about figures like Black Elk and all these other people, that people get the idea, well, you know, that's for these great shamans or that's for... No, this experience is here and now, and you can get it. It's not something that is only for the great ones in some other time or place.
Would you be comfortable telling about your hallucinogenic drug experience that you recount in the book?
You mean the brownies?
Yeah, the hash brownie story. I want you to do that, because I think I thought it was good to share that candidly, but I thought you learned something during that process which speaks to this need we have for linear time, and perhaps why linear time is what's driving us so crazy. The myth of the great ending, why we've been longing for the end of days since the beginning of time, that we look for significance. The reasons why we want an apocalypse now. Why is it that something we want when it would be the most horrible thing to go through? What is it that would bring about? I'll give you another argument. I think a lot of people are just so tired from this linear existence that secretly they wish for an apocalypse just so they can get some sleep. I mean that. It takes all the pressure off. But more on that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. The myth of the great ending. Joseph Felser is talking about why it is that the world has ended, is ending, and never will end next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. So we're talking with Dr. Joseph Felser, the myth of the great ending. And so this idea of circular time versus linear time and how we stand between that was something which I think it's a concept we can all relate to. But for a lot of people, it might as well be. You might as well be talking about life, living life underwater, that they just feel like they'll never get there and they'll never be able to, you know, to live in a bubble like Aquaman. So why are we even having this conversation? And yet I think any steps we can take toward a less linear understanding of how our life works, then the happier we're going to be. We'll get closer back to our natural rhythm. You agree?
Oh, yes, I agree. Absolutely. I think there are different ways of doing it. And different techniques that people might use. That experience of timelessness that I was that we were talking about before, I think is available. You don't have to be a great mystic to have it. And I think you're right.
No, and I bring that up because you had this experience with hash brownies.
I hope my students aren't listening to this.
I hope they are. They should know this about their professor. But this is, you know, you had your one big experiment, but it at least was, it gave you a profound understanding of something, so it wasn't a total waste.
Well, it wasn't the first experience that I had with an alteration of time. I would say maybe when I was 5 years old, I seemed to experience time slowing down, and this had nothing to do with drugs or having a fever or anything. It was an experience that happened to me spontaneously at night, perhaps when I was sleeping, perhaps when I was awake. I wasn't even sure, but I did experience time differently. So I think, you know, the physicists tell us that, you know, time is basically our experience, and we can change our experience, and therefore we can change time in that sense, that, you know, time is not out there objectively, and it's basically inside our consciousness. And when we change our consciousness, then we change time, as it were. And the experience you're talking about, I had when I was senior in college, and this wasn't a regular thing that I did. In fact, it was the one and only time that I did it. My friend said, "Well, you have to taste my girlfriend's hash brownies." And I took some bites of it. It tasted like straw. It was awful. And we were sitting around their apartment, and they said, "Well, let's go somewhere." And where do you want to go? I don't know. Where do you want to go? So we wound up going to the Museum of Science, of all places. And this was in Boston. And by the time we got there, I just noticed that, you know, I was different. And of course, everything is funny, no matter what it is, it's funny. But then I started noticing this strange thing about time, and it seemed to me, I remember standing in the museum looking at the exhibits, and it seemed to me like I was in one of those old-fashioned, where they have the strobe light, you know?
Right.
Like a disco?
Right, sure.
The universe, it seemed to me, was blinking on and off, on and off, on and off. And this was was disturbing to me. I mean, I couldn't understand what was going on. At first, I thought it was actually a physical effect out there. I thought that, you know, someone was literally playing with the lights. And then I realized that this was just part of the effect of having ingested the brownie. And eventually, that sense of discontinuity of this, you know, what we would think of as we don't experience it. It's like we're watching a movie and we don't see the individual frames, because it's the frames are being taken through that source of light so quickly that to us it's a continuum, And that's normally the way we experience time. And what this was doing, evidently, if this is my retrospective analysis, was it was slowing that down so that I was experiencing the spaces in between the frames. And then later on, I remember looking at my watch, and it was, of course, it wasn't digital watch. There weren't digital watches then, so it was one of those things where the hand goes around the dial, and the hand wasn't moving, or it would take a very long time to move. And so it was very instructive to me, really, because it did remind me a little bit of the experience that I had when I was much younger of time sort of slowing down. It was almost like molasses coming out of a bottle instead of pouring a soda out of a bottle. And so that made me think, and I've had these experiences, since I was a kid. I wouldn't even call them mystical experiences. I just call them, like Maslow calls them peak experiences. And it gave me a lot of pause for thought.
I've had that experience where time seemed to come totally still, and you felt like every tick of the clock sounded almost like a barrel falling down steps. But for me, there was no drugs involved. It was actually one of my recitals that I used to have to go to with my kids. And the kids would take 19 minutes to play chopsticks. That's what it felt like. But I think what's so interesting about this idea of divorcing oneself off the linear time is it comes back to then perhaps the reason why today people are so obsessed with end times and wanting there to be an end times is that subconsciously we're all very tired. And it would just be nice, not just that there should be some sort of purpose to our life, but perhaps, this is a way of saying, I give up. It's just, I regardless of whether they think they'll be the ones that will make it in through the gates of heaven, they'll at very least, it'll be over. And whatever it is, it takes all the pressure off continuing if outside of your own control, it's over.
Yes. Well, and I think that goes back to what Joe Campbell was talking about when he talks about that period that he calls the Great Reversal. And what happened to the circle during that time period? The circle had been a symbol of harmony and of unity. And then Campbell says basically it got caught up in the invention of the war chariot, and the spoked wheel becomes a symbol of terror and the awfulness of life.
Yeah, I think you have to explain that war chariot idea, because I think that's a really, because those two things, then linear time and the war chariot, become exported at the same time. So I want you to be a little more specific about that idea that how much the war chariot changed the world.
Well, I mean, the wheel was only invented, I guess, around 3,000 years BCE, supposedly. I guess it was Mesopotamia, ancient Sumer. And maybe it took a while. I guess it took about 1,000 years after that for the war chariot to be developed, which is the light spoked wheels put on a basket kind of thing to hold
right.
The soldiers and essentially they were the first tanks whatever you want to call it. So the first artillery, the first tanks, it made armies extremely mobile and extremely powerful. And that invention, the whole idea of mass conquering warfare, which starts during that same time period, then exports both the war and its technology, and of course the stories that are behind those technologies and so forth. So all of this goes out, again, starting from the Near East through to Asia, to North Africa, and so on and so forth. So this identification of the wheel as a kind of a symbol of terror and how awful life can become, like you say, and this longing for extinction from the suffering of life. Now, in the Hindu tradition, in the Asian traditions in general, I think that they have kept the cyclical view of time. But the thing is that there you have all life is sorrowful. The first noble truth, the first great truth of Buddhism is all life is sorrowful. So again, you have a kind of sense of the wheel or the hoop or the circle as a symbol of the suffering of life, and the aim there is then to get off of the wheel of rebirth, and not have to come back again to be reborn or be reincarnated. So they don't talk about there being an absolute end to time. They just talk about the individual opting out, so to speak. And so they've kept the symbol, but the accent is no longer on the symbol as a positive thing, as a harmonious as a symbol of harmonizing oneself, but as a symbol of, gee, let's get out of here.
Right. Yeah. And this is earlier than I thought time had shifted into, or the perception of time had shifted into a linear understanding. I honestly didn't think that that was something that we did until we got much further removed from the agrarian cultures that, you know, we all grew up in at one point, and more into the cities and the need to mark people's productivity. I always thought that was the beginning of linear time.
Well, I think you have to look at the religious conceptions. I mean, I think that the later scientific and technological developments of those certainly build on those religious ideas. But the idea that time is a kind of sequence of unrepeatable moments, starting with a great beginning and then, you know, marching its way toward a great ending, I think that is a function of the myths, of the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think one of the things that, you know, I hope people take away from the book is the idea that we do have a choice about what kind of stories that we tell ourselves, and that if what the physicists tell us is right, and that our perceptions, the observer does influence what's observed, that we might be creating the thing that we say that we're afraid of, right. Or that we secretly long for, which would be that great ending. In other words, that it's just the kind of ultimate self-fulfilling prophecy, we do have an influence over how we experience time, and we've seen physicists keep telling us we have an influence over events in the external world, what we think of as the external world, because it's a reflection of our own consciousness of it. And so we have to be careful about what our consciousness is. We have a choice. Do we want to be crybabies and reject and you know, say, just, you know, I want to take my marbles home and I don't want to play anymore? Or do we act like Crazy Horse, you know, the great Oglala Sioux warrior, and say, well, it's a good day to fight and a good day to die, and let's affirm life with all of its pain and suffering, and this too shall pass. Everybody dies. Everything dies. But when that time comes, let's just accept it.
And I think another aspect of this is something you get at in the myth of the great ending when you're talking about Thomas Aquinas and others, is that there's a desire to feel like you won the game.
Yes. Yeah.
And that for some people, for their desire to see the end of the world as we know it in their lifetime, not an ending and then a new beginning, but just an ending, is the desire to be able to look down from heaven, perhaps, on others, and be able to say, I won, that my belief system won. And it seems sort of petty to destroy the world just to say, I won.
Yeah.
But that's where maybe a lot of people are rooted in this enormous sense of, if you will, sort of philosophical ego.
Well, the secular version of that is a bumper sticker from years ago. I remember, those who die with the most toys wins.
Right.
Yeah. That one. That's the materialistic secular version of that that great religious hope that, you know, my group is the one that's going to be saved, and you know, in the final judgment that we're going to win and everyone else is going to suffer.
And yet, you know, what we see time and time again from groups like perhaps the one that on the minds of many coming up in May, the Herald Camping Camp, that says that, you know, the second coming comes in on May 21st, 2011, is there's going to be a disconfirmation of those beliefs. There, you know, when May 21st comes and goes, and again, that'll be a Saturday, so I'll be on the air on Coast to Coast, and I'll either be able to finish the show or I won't, but I'm guessing I'll be able to finish. And then when that happens, those same groups are going to have to reassess their central number one core belief, as like so many other groups have done in human history where they were completely invested in a single event, a single time event that doesn't take place.
Yeah.
And then they have to rethink everything. And that'll be interesting to see what happens, because it doesn't often happen where a group that large will end up will go through that process of disorientation.
Yes. And there were the Millerites. I talk about this in the book, the Christian sect from the 1840s, who also, William Miller was a kind of prophet who decided that he knew when the second coming was, and he foretold it a couple of times, and after he was wrong a couple of times, that the movement sort of faded. But as you say, it happens over and over again that, the foretold end doesn't happen, and we go through these cycles of kind of manic depression about it. Let me say this about that. I think this points to another basic problem that we've already talked about, touched on, and that's this whole business about how we interpret. I mean, even if these things come from legitimate visions, how we interpret those visions and these myths, and the difficulty involved in interpreting these kinds of predictive and prophetic things. There was a study done some years ago. Actually, it was what they call a meta study. It was a study of studies. And what it was, Nancy Sandow, I think, of the American Society for Psychical Research, did this one of these meta studies of precognitive experiences, where people have dreams or intuitions about what's going to happen in the future.
Sure.
And what she found was, very interesting finding, was that there was a kind of inverse relationship between the accuracy of the prognostication and the time between the experience and the foretold event. In other words, put it bluntly, the further the event away in time, the more difficult it was to accurately foretell it. So that's one problem. So, for example, the other day someone was asking me, well, do you think that it's true that Nostradamus foresaw the Egyptian Revolution? And I just had to laugh. I mean, if you think about, Nostradamus' time and our time, even if Nostradamus could see in that far into the future, how could he conceptualize it? How could he conceptualize what people were doing, for example, when even if he saw the clear picture of them on their cell phones, how would he know what they were doing? So that's one factor involved. Even if you believe in the existence of precognition, which I do, I think it's a fact that people do see into the future. It's a very tricky thing. And then, of course, you have that question of interpretation and how you interpret these things, and you take these things literally or not. And so this business of, I keep coming up with different dates and so forth, it never ends.
Well, or will it? I mean, Harold Camping will eventually either run out of time or the earth will,
I think it'll be him.
Right. My money's on Harold Camping will end before the earth will, but we'll know more later on. But why is it then that you think there are so many people who long for the end of days? The myth of the great ending, Joseph Felser gets into both some interesting speculation of why it is that either some of us or all of us think about it from time to time, but also drawing greatly upon the work of Joseph Campbell and Black Elk. And you mentioned in the book about the Gospel of Thomas, and you said it was Gnostic.
Yes.
And there's a lot of belief that it actually isn't a Gnostic Christian text. I know that there's reason to suspect that it would be, but it's such an interesting collection of sayings that it may, in fact, predate the writing of the New Testament. That there's certain professors with whom I've spoken over the years that think the Gospel of Thomas is older than the New Testament writings, not younger than, not more recent.
No, I don't think. I would agree with that. I mean, I think that the Thomas Gospel comes out of the same oral sources as the New Testament. So basically what it's doing is it's translating those original oral sources that were not written down yet into a Gnostic understanding of the meaning of those. And so instead of a literal historical interpretation of a mass event yet to come, it's interpreted in more spiritual metaphorical terms as referring to an inward psycho-spiritual transformation event that you yourself must bring about.
Right. And that's so much of what the myth of the great ending is about. So much of what we associate with the ending of time is really just an ending of a time in our own lives, that we all go through ages. We all go through phases. And can we accept that a phase of our life, an age within our lifetime, must come to an end for a new and better age to come? And maybe that's all that's ever meant by these great prophecies about the end of time. It's not the end of physical time or a physical existence, but of a thought system that has to go, a leaky bucket that needs to be retired so that we get one that's more functional. Well, that's where we'll end this until we get to your calls coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.